Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam, we get to talk with Senior Associate Dean for Faculty and Research at the Duke Sanford School of Public Policy, Dr. Philip Cook, about preventing gun violence.
You know, Christy, we did a show probably last year or maybe longer where we interviewed one of the survivors of the Virginia Tech shooting, and that was so powerful, but so much has happened since then, and there's so much on the table that we want to learn about and we know our listeners are interested in.
Absolutely, an important topic for our nation. But first, we have some other research that matters about tennis elbow and shots that can possibly help or not.
Or hurt. About if you have diabetes or a loved one has diabetes, should you acquiesce to insurance rules that limit how often you can test? Is that good for your health?
About yoga, potentially helping people who have an irregular heart rhythm.
And finally, the whooping cough and the vaccines to prevent it. Should pregnant women have them? This is really some important research. Let's dive right in, Christy. This first research that matters was in the Journal of the American Medical Association. It was about a very common condition called tennis elbow. We sometimes call it inflammation of the ligaments of the elbow. And since I'm a tennis player, I know all about this.
Well, and the question is, have you ever gotten a steroid shot or given one for tennis elbow?
I've given plenty of shots for this, though I've given less over the last few years because I had some concerns as to people got better, it seemed like, pretty quickly after I gave the shot. Of course, I put lidocaine or numbing medicine in it, but I wasn't so certain if the long-term treatment was better. This research looks at it.
It does. This is a study from Denmark that looked at 165 adults that were randomly assigned. They had tennis elbow. They were randomly assigned to one of four different groups, either the cortisone shots with physical therapy, placebo shots with physical therapy, cortisone shots with no PT or physical therapy, and the placebo shots without physical therapy. So all these different groups that mixed.
That's a mouthful.
I know. These groups that mixed either getting steroids or placebo and mixed with getting physical therapy or not.
Right. And a placebo shot is like they may not have any steroid in it, but they might have normal saline or essentially salt water that they could inject in that area, then there's no reason to believe that that alone would help people. And surprise over surprise, 1 year later, pretty much everyone was the same except the people who got the steroid shot actually did a little worse.
Yeah, it was really remarkable. The people who got, about 83% of the people who got the steroid shot felt that they had completely recovered from tennis elbow by a year. But the people who got placebo, 96% of them were better in a year. So a higher percentage of the ones who didn't get the steroids did better.
And I think part of that is when you get the steroid shot, you get this immediate little boost. Maybe it's the power of the steroids, the needle, the pain we're losing, and maybe you go back to what you're doing. Worse is the treatment, though, is to stay away from what was causing it. You have to modify the behavior and give adequate rest. And it sounds like the people in the steroid shots didn't do that. Could be the steroids actually made them worse. We don't know. But what's the take-home message for you, Christy?
I think the take-home message is if you have tennis elbow or pain in that area, that doing anti-inflammatory medications, doing some exercises and stretching, resting that arm, those things are probably more beneficial than trying to get a steroid shot. And I would be, I would want to talk to the doctor if the doctor recommended that to really understand, do they know about this latest research?
Yeah, we would avoid the only type of needles that maybe we would maybe talk about is something like acupuncture,
right,
but something that's not sticking into the joint or sticking steroids into it. So I think we would agree it may be a very different paradigm, different treatment. What about this next research that matters, Christy?
So this is about the frequency of blood sugar testing for patients with diabetes who have type 1 diabetes. So this is over a million Americans that have type 1 diabetes. And we frequently encourage people to test their blood to figure out how insulin is working or not working in their body, but there have been some regulations about that with insurance companies.
And so in this particular article that was published in the journal Diabetes Care, appropriately enough, they looked at the control of the diabetes for those who had frequent testing up to 10 times a day, and for those who checked it maybe 4 times a day. And it turned out those who were checking it up to 10 times a day was significantly better blood sugar control. Now, this is interesting because most people don't want to check their blood sugar 10 times a day, but maybe some people really need to do that, and the insurance companies might not pay for that.
Well, and that needs to change. I mean, currently, the American Diabetes Association encourages people who have diabetes to check their blood sugar at least 3 times a day. But it may mean that those recommendations need to change to more frequently, and certainly that insurance companies should be, you know, more giving to pay for that.
Well,
especially if you get better diabetes control, which means better health, and
we would think that would be kind of a no-brainer. Except these strips are expensive; they're up to 70 cents per strip, so that can really add up. And I had a patient with type 2 diabetes, Christy, just today, earlier, who wanted to check their blood sugar more than once a day. Mm-hmm. And with the type 2 diabetes, it's very difficult sometimes to get the insurance companies to give you it for more than once a day because they're not on insulin. And they wanted to check it more frequently, and they thought it would give them better blood sugar control. So I think this is an issue for pretty much all of our patients with diabetes who really want to take control of their own lives. Well, I think we need some change.
Certainly, if you're on insulin, then checking it more often is a good idea. Okay, let's talk about yoga and atrial fibrillation.
Well,
what do they have to do with each other?
Well, I know I don't have atrial fibrillation, but I do do yoga, and I believe that it's really beneficial. So if you ask me, though, would I believe it was beneficial for people who have this abnormal heart rhythm, I'd say, I'm not so certain.
So about 2.7 million people in the United States have what's called atrial fibrillation, that funny heart rhythm where the different chambers of the heart don't squeeze in synchrony with one another. Irregularly irregular.
Right.
So this was a study looking at 49 people who had this atrial fibrillation for an average of 5 years, following them over 3 months and then longer to see if what group yoga classes led twice a week did to their symptoms.
And this was published actually in the journal of the American College of Cardiology, a very prestigious journal. And they found that those who had the yoga, their heart rate actually decreased from the beginning of the study to post-yoga by about 5 to 7 beats. Their anxieties also scores also declined, so that people in general felt better. That's a good thing.
I think it's great. I mean, it's important to stress that it's not that yoga cures the atrial fibrillation, but it can help lower the pulse, improve anxiety scores, and overall that leads to good things, I think.
And this was not, we should stress, this was not one of those RCTs, that randomized controlled trial, that gold standard of how you maybe do these studies to find out if you had two different groups, would one improve better? And so we don't for sure know if this is going to produce that effect for you if you had atrial fibrillation or your loved one. But on the other hand, other than the cost, which is not cheap, this is probably has no downside.
If you can afford it, it's worth a try.
There you go. What about this last research that matters, Christy, about pregnant women in the whooping cough that was in the Annals of Internal Medicine?
Yeah, this is has led to a new recommendation about pertussis vaccine, something called the Tdap. And it's a tetanus that has a little booster of pertussis protection in it that is now recommended for all pregnant women with each pregnancy to get this booster.
And the main reason is that even though we start immunizing the child after the child is born at 2 months and 4 months and 6 months, for those first 2 months, the child doesn't have protection. And they cited it was an outbreak of whooping cough in California in 2010 in which 10 infants died. So the question is there any downside for the pregnant women to get this immunization?
Well, and in this case, the immunization gives the mother some immunity immediately, but also some immunity that passes on to the baby. So it's not just protecting the parents from getting sick, but also providing some short-term immunity for the baby, which can help protect them if they get exposed. So, I mean, it sounds like from a safety and from a thinking about the overall benefit that it's a really good idea.
So we'll be talking about this more with your providers when you're pregnant, by all means. Well, Christy, that'll conclude our Research That Matters. We've had a chance to talk not only about this new recommendation for whooping cough vaccine in pregnant women.
About yoga, possibly helping people who have atrial fibrillation.
About for diabetic care for our loved ones. Testing more often, if it leads to better blood sugar control, is a good thing.
And finally, that steroid shots for a tennis elbow might actually be harmful and certainly don't appear to be helpful in the long run. Thanks for taking time to talk about those, Adam. Those were good research this time. That does conclude the Research Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Philip Cook about preventing gun violence. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're talking with the Senior Associate Dean for Faculty and Research and National Expert at the Duke Sanford School of Public Policy, Dr. Philip Cook, about preventing gun violence. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Cook.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm glad to be with you.
Well, thanks for being with us. You know, Dr. Cook, you are an expert and have dedicated a large portion of your career to crime prevention and gun violence. What is it that's made this so important to you as a major focus?
Yeah, actually, I just finished a memoir of my 37 years working in the area. It is a bit discouraging looking back that not more has been accomplished during that time. But you know, I originally got into it just as part of my general interest in crime and the technology of crime. And it was clear that the role of guns had been ignored for too long, and it seemed to be a very important part of robbery and assault, and certainly homicide. So that my first studies were just on that topic, about what difference does a gun make.
Well, we certainly have seen some dramatic changes over this period of time, not all bad, in reduction of some things like homicides, right?
In the U.S. Oh, absolutely. The homicide rate has been declining really since 1991, and our rate today is about half of what it was then. So that is an extraordinary change. It's meant that in many a city now that they've become much more livable than they were previously, that they've improved property values, that their populations are increasing, and in all kinds of ways the standard of living has improved as a result of the simple fact that they're safer.
So if that's the case, well, first off, I think your research and others who's helped reshape perhaps how as a society we, you know, something has contributed to that, right? It hasn't just happened magically, or is that all just due to improved economic conditions of the public?
Well, there has been, unfortunately, very little improvement in the economic condition of the public or the socioeconomic standing of households during that time. So it is fair to say that to a large extent, the decline in crime has been something of a mystery. Nobody predicted it, and yet it happened. There's been a lot of Monday morning quarterbacking by criminologists. But I think that one thing that should be clear in our context is that gun violence is the combination of violence and guns. And certainly one way we have successfully reduced gun violence in this country is to reduce the overall amount of violence.
Well, and you point out in your article about, you know, guns don't kill people, they just make it real easy. And as we think about policies and an approach, this is back on the table. Each new massacre and new horrible act, with most recently the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting, raises this issue back in the media. And I wonder sort of what we're going to start going through the policies that you would suggest. Where do we start? Where do we start making headway from what we all agree are horrific acts into real prevention?
Right. I think that, you know, it's important to realize that even though we have become safer against crime and against gun crime, that it is still a compelling issue and one that places a great burden in many areas, especially in the cities. Where do we start if we're thinking about homicide and gun assault and robbery? You know, I think that we finally have some presidential leadership in this area. Really nothing said about guns and gun control during the first Obama term, but since the Newtown massacre, he has led the way on a particular set of policies. And there's some hope that Congress will actually adopt one of them, and that is the universal background check. That strikes me as a very reasonable place to begin if we are going to regulate guns more strongly.
Well, help us understand this universal background check, because we do know that the Brady Act required in maybe 8 or 9 years ago, I don't remember the exact date, but required background checks on guns sold through stores like Walmart's, but it doesn't require background checks on guns sold through individuals. Help us understand what that really means and why that change might be helpful.
Right. It actually was adopted in 1994, so time flies. And since 1998, there has been a universal requirement that guns purchased at from gun dealers be subjected to a background check, mostly checking on criminal history to see whether or not the buyer was disqualified because the buyer was a felon or had a misdemeanor conviction in association with domestic violence. But the Brady Act left private sales unregulated and private transfers unregulated. So that turns out to be a gaping loophole in the whole apparatus that accounts for something like 80 or 90% of all of the sales that produce crime. That if you know, there have been a number of studies where convicted criminals are asked, where did they get their gun? Very rarely do they say, I went to a dealer and got the gun. Hmm. They say they got it on the street, they got it from a friend, they got it from a family member, they stole it, but they only mention a dealer. Maybe it's between 10 and 20% of the time.
And so how do we enforce that? So if you're selling your gun to someone else, what exactly has to happen, and how do we enforce that?
I mean, we have some models. Right now, 6 states have a universal background check requirement. Probably the most prominent is California, which has had one in place since 1991. Technically, North Carolina requires that if you're going to buy a handgun, even in a private sale, that you get a permit from the local sheriff, that kind of thing. And that goes back to 1921, so it's a very old law. But the way that it works in California, for example, is that if I wanted to sell a gun to my next-door neighbor, that we would have to arrange to involve a federally licensed dealer in the transaction. And the dealer would charge $10, or as much as $10 in California, for the service of providing a background check in the usual way. And the transfer then would only take place after that background check had been demonstrated that the buyer was qualified to own a gun.
The other question I have about background checks, I have some suspicion from seeing some video where someone had a video camera and went into the gun shows and just at how little the background checks were actually implemented. Are we making headway or planning to make headway in enforcing the rules that already exist?
Well, most states don't regulate gun shows, so that if there's a private seller in a gun show, then they are legally entitled to sell guns without conducting a background check, just as you and I are entitled to sell guns to friends and family and anybody else and to list them on Craigslist. So that part of the market is largely unregulated unless it's regulated by the state.
How is it that we have that and we can't, that there are such big loopholes?
That would require an answer in terms of the politics of gun control, I suppose.
Christy is sitting here incredulous for all of our listeners out there, and I'm sure many of them are also kind of incredulous. That would seem to be something obvious. But right before we take a break, help us understand who is opposed to this particular policy change and why.
But, you know, the answer is very few people are opposed to it. The national polls show 90% support universal background checks of the American adult public, including overwhelming majorities of gun owners and even of people who say they are members of the National Rifle Association. So the opposition is coming from the National Rifle Association. And I think that they oppose it just because they oppose pretty much any increase in the regulation of guns. And they talk about how it would be inconvenient for people who currently like to buy and sell guns informally, privately, outside of the regulatory apparatus that we have. And that's true. Of course, it would be inconvenient. You know, there would be an extra half hour or something that was required to involve a dealer.
Well, speaking of a half hour, we're going to take a short break, but only for just a minute.
Okay.
But when we return, we're going to continue talking with our guest, Dr. Philip Cook, national expert about preventing gun violence. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Philip Cook, Senior Associate Dean for Faculty and Research at the Duke Sanford School of Public Policy, about preventing gun violence. And we wanted to bring in this conversation of mental health and its relationship to gun violence. I understand there's some efforts to have some assessment of mental health. I know, Adam, you've been involved in this recently in writing a piece.
Well, Dr. Cook, help us understand, first off, what is the history here of how well we currently keep guns out of those with severe mental illness, and then what's on the table?
The 1968, the Gun Control Act was adopted by Congress, and it had a list of the kinds of people who were disqualified from buying a gun or possessing a gun. And on that list was a group that was designated as those who were adjudicated mentally ill. And actually, the phrase was adjudicated mentally defective. And the reference was to people who had been committed by judicial order to a mental hospital, or who had been found not guilty by reason of insanity in a trial. So that's the disqualified group that is relevant here. There is also a disqualification for people who are regular users of drugs, but there's very little application of that rule. So what we've seen since the Virginia Tech shootings in 2007 is an increased focus on improving the database that we have of people who have been sent to a mental hospital by a judge's order. And increasingly, there are states now that will have access to lists of people who are disqualified for that reason. And it has become part of the instant background check for that reason. It's still a small fraction of the total, but it's improving over time.
So that's an effort to capture the most disabled people in terms of their mental health from having guns. There's also been these new forms that we're getting as physicians to state whether or not a patient has any mental health history.
Or physical health problems such as Alzheimer's or arthritis or seizures or Parkinson's, that, you know, and how well can we know whether or not our patients are safe to use these? I'm not sure I know that answer. Have you ever come up with this?
There are forms for concealed weapons, so that would help them then be able to carry around a gun in their car or conceal it in some way.
Yeah, carry it out in public. And, you know, of course, the states differ greatly in terms of what rules they have for issuing these concealed carry permits. And North Carolina is a bit more restrictive than some, but that's interesting.
Well, it's bizarre to think about doctors trying to weigh in on the safety of that overall.
I think it is very difficult to put doctors in that position. The fact is that it remains true that our best predictors of violence are a history of violence, to start with, and beyond that would be age, and probably being a male as opposed to female, and of course, mental illness of certain kinds and drug addiction can also be predictive. So what would be far better than to have the clinical judgment of a physician in this area would be to have good records on the individual and about their history of violence, and about any kind of comorbid condition such as drug addiction, which is then predictive of violence and can be made into a formula.
Well, let's talk about the things that are really on the table right now. Huge issues, bans on assault weapons and limits on the amount of bullets that can be fired at one kind of sitting, so to speak. Tell us how likely those types of bans would perhaps cut down on gun violence. And then do you think that those sorts of bans are likely to pass in the next year or two in Congress?
You know, of course, we did have a ban on large capacity magazines in the 1994 law that Congress adopted that was directed against assault weapons, and that lasted for 10 years. The problem was that there was no ban on using the large capacity magazines that were already in circulation, and so it wasn't that difficult for people to buy secondhand the 30-shot magazine or the 100-shot magazine that was already out there. And I think that would remain a problem in the future. But the purpose of this is very specific against rampage shootings. It's against the kind of slaughters that we have seen in places like the Sandy Hook Elementary or the Virginia Tech or Columbine, where it allows the shooter to continue shooting without interruption if they have that kind of capacity. And if we want to do something about those mass shootings, then this could make sense. The fact is, though, that it has not a prayer in Congress under the current regime. I think that where we might see some action, and we actually have seen some action, is in some states.
So if we're going to then really make headway, we probably have to deal with the fact that 90% of the injuries that occur in violent, it comes from handguns, right? From what I've read, and suicides. We've talked about homicides and suicides and the lethality of the methods. What is our solution outside of the legislative work? Because we have a unique culture here. You mentioned you were pessimistic. Do we really have to do something different throughout our educational system, throughout our family system, our churches? What's some of the solutions?
Well, I think that it would be helpful to have a basic education in the dangers of keeping a gun in the home that would be useful for families themselves to understand that if they bring a gun into the home, and if they have teenagers in that home, or if they have people that drink heavily, or if they have family conflicts, that they have added a major risk factor, which very much more likely to be used against a family member than to be used against an intruder. So the sad thing in this area is that so many people acquire guns to make their home safer, and that then they end up being used as a suicide or in an accident or being used against another family member.
That's a real paradox from what people are trying to make themselves safer and, in fact, making it more dangerous for their loved ones, at least statistically speaking.
Exactly right. That it's so easy to imagine being helpless in the face of an intruder and wanting to have something that can be done about that. But in fact, fortunately, that tends to be extremely rare. Much less rare is all of the other things that can go wrong when you have a gun around. And that's I think, the important message to get out. I think it's obviously important for healthcare providers to understand that the mechanism here matters a lot, that if they know about somebody who is having suicidal thoughts, that a high priority should be to separate them from guns, because guns are so much more lethal than many of the other means that are commonly used in an attempted suicide.
We're going to have to finish in just a second, but could you just say for maybe 30 seconds about community-oriented policing from a community perspective in your article, Dr. Cook? I found this interesting and something I wasn't really quite aware of, that this is an effective also intervention that maybe all of us could agree on.
Well, I think that's right, that a number of cities, and most prominently New York City, places a great emphasis on getting guns off the street. They have the legal framework to do that, and that's the priority for them, far more than controlling the drug trade or some other things. And of course, New York has led the way in this remarkable drop in violence. So that's the, interesting possibility, that it is something we can all agree on to support the police in taking on the most important issue in many cities, and that is the misuse of guns.
Well, I think we could all agree on that. You have been helpful to the American public in your writing and thinking, and we appreciate your help with our listeners today.
Well, I appreciate the chance to talk to them. Thanks, Adam and Christy.
We've been talking with Dr. Philip Cook from the Duke Sanford School of Public Policy about preventing gun violence. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
If you have questions you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, send them to us at yourhealth@unc.edu. And Christy, we have some really good questions today about people who are going on a missionary trip to Africa and what type of shots they should get.
About cold sores and which medicine is better.
About pain in the stomach and what to do about it.
And finally, about atrial fibrillation and blood pressure pulse questions and medication.
Great. Well, let's just listen to our very first house call.
I'm considering taking my children on a mission trip to Africa this summer. What medical things do I need to prepare?
Well, good for you for going on an international trip, and sounds like it's service-focused. I think there are a lot of elements that we could include in this, Adam. Part of it depends on what part of Africa you're going to. The good news is there's a lot of good information on cdc.gov if you go and kind of click on
Centers for Disease Control's website on international travel. That's by the way, we're going to give you a secret that's worth at least $180. When you come to see a travel medicine physician, that's where they go. When they leave the room, they go look up on the CDC's website, and they come back in, because it's not like we can memorize for every single country of the world what shots you need, but that's what they do.
It is, and they do it really well. It is helpful, and you mentioned this, Adam, to make an appointment with your doctor or a travel medicine clinic. If your doctor offers these services, that's ideal because they know your medical history and the like. But there are also separate travel clinics that can help you.
I recently saw a patient, Christy, who's going down to South America. And when we looked up on the CDC's website, the complications of these things is that sometimes you have to see what area of the country you're going to, the urban versus the rural areas. What's the risk of malaria? What's the risk of yellow fever? And it's real clear once the CDC maps this out. So those are the major things. You have to worry about rabies if you're going to be with animals in rural areas, or meningococcal if you haven't had that vaccination.
That's exactly right. But you can go through these things, and the CDC printout that you could print or download really goes through each of the elements of what vaccines you need.
Hepatitis A, for instance.
Mm-hmm, what malaria prevention you need that's specific for that area. And also some travel tips that are really helpful about things like DEET and good bug spray to prevent.
Preventing traveler's diarrhea, or treating it if it comes about. Mm-hmm. And just being safe and have a safety plan. Well, let us know how that trip goes. And we look forward to hopefully that you stayed healthy.
Great.
Let's
Thank you for your question.
Our next house call.
My dad got some cold sores on his mouth, and the doctor prescribed a medicine that starts with acyclovir. I heard from friends that a medicine called Valtrex is better. Should I ask that he get switched to Valtrex? Is it really better?
Well, cold sores are never fun.
No. Unfortunately, they're very common. And there are good medicines, though, the Valtrex that you mentioned and acyclovir, which is sort of the older, cheaper, tried and true medicine, that can make the symptoms better.
And I'm going to assume here, Christy, that what they are talking about here is herpes of the mouth.
Right.
Because cold sores can also mean different things to different people. This could mean canker sores, or
That's
we
true.
Sometimes call aphthous ulcers, or viral-induced ulcers on the inside of the mouth and the inside of the lips. When we talk about the cold sores, frequently it's the ones you can see on the outside of the lips. That's the one that we would think of as herpes.
And there is some studies showing that Valtrex, you could take a higher dose and have a shorter treatment period. But it is more expensive than acyclovir.
A lot more. like 8 to 10 times more.
The benefit of not having to take it as many times a day is positive, but I'm unconvinced that it's any better than acyclovir. It's just more expensive.
Right. So if you forget to take your medicine 5 times a day, like you have to do frequently with acyclovir, you might want to just do the Valtrex.
Sure.
And if you got great insurance, you might. I mean, if with our insurance, which is really good, I might take the Valtrex. It's a heck of a lot more convenient.
I certainly would,
too. If I was paying out of my own pocket, hey, Cyclovir.
That's exactly my perspective on it, too. Well, good luck. I hope the medicine makes a difference for your dad. Let's take our next house call.
I've had pain in my upper stomach on and off for months. It seems to hurt when I eat, but also when I'm not eating. My dad has bad reflux, so I thought this is what it was. But taking Prilosec every day has not helped. The pain comes and goes, and at times it is excruciating. It even woke me up from sleep the other night. Do you think this is reflux, or could it be something else?
Wow. I would say it could be reflux, but if you've got no improvement with consistent Prilosec, which is one of those PPIs or proton pump inhibitors that reduces the acid, then I would definitely be considering other possibilities.
Yeah, I think when you say, could it be something else? I'd say, uh-huh.
Yes.
It probably is something else because most reflux really does respond. And reflux that was there long enough or associated with an ulcer could actually be an ulcer. So it may have started as reflux, and you know, but it could well be an ulcer now. And pain, most people have reflux that's uncomfortable, but they don't really tell us that they have pain. When we hear pain, we think things like ulcer, like
gallstones, your pancreas can get inflamed, pancreatitis, particularly if you drink alcohol.
People could have even
hepatitis or liver inflammation.
Yeah, they could have a hiatal hernia which people sometimes hear about. Doesn't usually cause symptoms. It can. So lots of possibilities. This is one that we're going to encourage you to go make an appointment with your primary care physician.
Yep, and talk about the possibilities. There may be some blood tests and possibly an ultrasound that could be helpful to take a look.
Hope you feel better. Thank you so much for a house call that may help others also feel better. Let's listen to our very last house call.
My mom has atrial fibrillation, and the doctors put her on metoprolol. Then her heartbeat dropped too low, and they had to change the medicine. Does this mean that something even worse is wrong with her heart?
Well, that's a complicated question in that it's possible there was something else going on. But one of the things that metoprolol, which is one of those beta blocker medicines, it's very good for patients with atrial fibrillation. It lowers the blood pressure and lowers the pulse. But if those things drop too low, then they do often have to change the medicines.
And sometimes we think atrial fibrillation, the heart's beating real fast all the time. It's fibrillating and, you know, in high intensity. But sometimes atrial fibrillation can be controlled on your own body, even without the medicines. So you may have atrial fibrillation, but your heart rate might be 60 to start with. So if that's your case and you have this beta blocker that slows your heart rate down, it could drop it too low. The question is, what was your heart rate to start with? If it were 130, we wouldn't expect the beta blocker to really drop it too low.
And if your mom can tolerate the beta blocker,
That's the metoprolol,
or a medicine like it, it is good for her long term to have that on board in most settings for patients with atrial fibrillation. But if it drops it too low and you can't find a medicine that works in that way, it may not be worth it.
We talk about sometimes a different type of blocker, a calcium channel blocker. And don't ask me the mechanism by which it works, but it does work. It's inexpensive relatively, and it may not change that heart rate so much. Does it mean something's worse with her heart? Not necessarily, but again, this is one of those things you really have to get checked out. Well, that'll conclude our house calls today. Christy, we'd like any of our listeners who would like to send us their own questions to please send them to us at yourhealth@unc.edu.
And you can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, follow us on Twitter, on Facebook, on iTunes, and our new health app. Just search Your Health, one word, for a free download at the App Store.
We'd like to thank the staff at WCHL, the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our great guest today, Dr. Philip Cook. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
We can't wait to talk with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM, WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.